back to the fall of 22 here at HFC.
Yes, thank you, Susan, and thank you for always helping us to get the word out about our events, and especially for supporting the Hawk's Nest, which is a very important service that we have here for our students at Henry Ford College.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about it. The food restocking drive, it's called Stock the Pantry Food Drive, taking place now until the 16th, and I know donations can be accepted at any time, but this is really, I think, probably even more a way to kind of make sure that everything is plenished as it needs to be for the start of the semester, but also to teach people that it exists, that we have this food pantry here, and that it is accessible and available to all students of the college. And why don't you give us a little bit of maybe sort of the history of the food drive and exactly how we can help?
Yes. Usually every fall we'll do a Restock the Pantry food drive. This year I think it's going to be extremely important with more students coming back to campus. I think our numbers of students using the pantry again will increase as it was pre-pandemic. I know a lot of students right now are struggling, as we all are, with inflation and, you know, trying to find work and being out of work during the pandemic. So we know that it's going to increase greatly this fall semester. So we are looking for donations of all kinds for food, personal care items, and then people can also make donations, monetary donations, in our office, which is in the Student Center, or online through the Foundation office on the HFC website, so they can make a donation through that as well. And our pantry is open to any student that's currently enrolled at HFC. They're allowed to come and visit the pantry twice a month. And get food items, get personal care items, and we do have some household items as well, cleaning supplies, napkins, stuff like that, that would help them out as well. The pantry will be open on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And right now, the students do have to make an appointment. I currently don't have a student workers that is running the pantry, so I'm not able to be over there all of the time. So they do need to make an appointment so that I can make sure it's available for them to pick up.
Okay. That's a lot of information, but I know it takes an awful lot to make this functional, and particularly for a student that is in some very specific need. It seems like, you know, if one thing isn't easy or convenient or, made aware, then they're not going to do it. And the thing that I know you on a daily basis are trying to do is to remove those barriers or those roadblocks so that the people that have the need can get the need satisfied and get it and get what will make them a more successful student. How many students are we serving, Mandy, these days? And is there a like a typical age range? You know, how specific does it get?
So pre-pandemic, we were probably seeing about 200 different students a semester. During the pandemic, it dropped drastically to probably about 30 students a semester. And I think a lot of that was due to transportation. So we know that students who struggle with hunger also struggle with homelessness, transportation, as well. So I think a lot of them weren't able to get to campus just to pick up the food. Now that students are coming back to campus for full days and classes, I think that's going to increase again. Though I would say we'll probably get back up to at least high 60s, 70s this semester. And then as the word continues to get out, I think it will continue to increase. And our students range from 17-year-olds in the early college program all the way up to, you know, adults that come back to school. So I think we've had students using the pantry that were probably in their 60s. So it ranges, just like our student population does.
Mm-hmm. And there is no discrimination based on any of that, of course, nor, as I understand, is there a need to prove need. Talk about that a little bit.
Yep. So the only thing that students need to do is we do have a registration form they have to fill out once a academic year. And then each semester, they also have to just show that they're currently enrolled. So they have to be currently enrolled in the fall semester to use it this fall. And that just means showing us the copy of their schedule for the fall semester. We don't ask for any type of need, financial need, anything like that to prove that they need to use the pantry. If they want to get something from the pantry, they need something from the pantry, they're welcome to come over and use the pantry.
Okay. When we talk about the pantry, where is the pantry?
The pantry is located in the administration building, which is the ASCC. It's on the first floor, and it's L138.
Okay, L138. And as you indicated, currently we're all experiencing shortages of one form or another, and student worker shortage is one thing that is happening. So you're encouraging students to call ahead or email ahead to make an appointment to come in. Are same-day appointments available typically during the hours that the pantry is sort of considered officially open, that the time frame that you mentioned a bit ago?
Usually, I can get their food ready for them within an hour of them completing all of the stuff. We're doing everything online right now, which we're going to probably continue to do even once we open, because I think that's convenient for the students to complete things online. And then also just to be able to pick up their food and go. That way, if they're running to class and they can just swing by and grab it, or if they need to leave to go to work, they can grab it real quickly. So we will continue to offer that as an option as well.
Okay. So if someone has not yet filled out even that initial form, that's something that can be done online, and then they can schedule to a pickup online as well, primarily. Yep. And I know certainly you're available by phone should there be any questions or concerns, and we'll give all that contact information in a minute. But so we want to make this very clear, is it a situation where people are sort of pre-ordering what they're looking for, or can they make an appointment and simply come in and sort of shop and pick out what sort of they've at the time while they're there, they think that would be beneficial to them?
So right now, since we don't have someone stationed over there, we're doing all like pre-orders. There's an order form that we offer them online that has every food item listed that we have available. So they will go through there and they will just check off exactly everything that they want. And then we'll use that order form to pack their bags for them.
Okay, excellent. So not unlike what the society is doing these days with remote pickup and so on. Anyway, so, okay, good. Well, thank you for that. And then in terms of contact information, before we get into some of the specific items that are being requested mostly by students and things that we, during this Stock the Pantry food drive taking place now until next Friday the 16th, so specifically, how is a student to reach you or to reach the information they need online?
So probably the best way to get information is to email our Hawk's Nest email address, and that is hawksnest@hawkmail.hfcc.edu. So it's a student email address, so just the beginning of it, Hawk's Nest, and then just like the end of their email address. And that's the best way to reach us and how to make an appointment as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Would you mind sharing your phone number just in case we've got somebody that's not quite ready to do the other?
Yes. So my office phone number is 313-317-1756.
Okay. Thank you, Mandy. 313-317-1756. And the Hawk's Nest, as Mandy mentioned, is open for the fall semester, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays for pickups. And hawksnest@hawkmail.hfcc.edu, which is a very well-known end of an email address for all students, because you've got one. You've got that hawkmail.hfcc.edu. So use that email address to schedule an appointment, and your items will be waiting for you when you arrive. For the food drive, Mandy, and again, to remind our listeners, Mandy Earle is joining us today. She is HFC's Student Activities Associate and just very involved in making sure that students are getting what they need to be successful. We're going to transition in a minute into another aspect of success on campus, and that is awareness of what's available on campus. But for this first part, we're talking about the availability of food items and also toiletries, personal care items, and things like that with the Stock the Pantry food drive. I'm looking at the list on our website, which is filled with things that I just consider staples of, any household. But I do notice that pretty much everything here is non-perishable, which is important, certainly. And also just pretty common stuff. So the things that you don't need, and I'll mention those things, you've got a good amount of corn, you got a good amount of green beans, peanut butter, and toothbrushes, right? So there are some things that you do need. And in the process of others, you know, looking at their own home pantries, saying, oh, I've got plenty of this, whatever, everything needs to be new, unopened, and unexpired, at least by a couple of months, if not more. So this isn't clean our pantry out and give it to another pantry of expired stuff. That's certainly not appropriate. So what are some of the most needed items currently that people could actually acquire and bring in or provide some financial donation support to, and then your team would pick it up?
So I would say definitely like heading into the fall semester, we go through a lot of like stew and chili, ravioli, things that they can heat up quickly, breakfast items. So breakfast bars, cereal, oatmeal, jelly. So we have a lot of peanut butter right now, but we don't have a lot of jelly to go along with that. And those kind of go hand in hand. And then we do like to have, some kind of more nutritious snack items, so like granola bars, peanuts. We do like crackers and cheese, crackers and peanut butter, those type of items, so that they have stuff when they're on campus. A lot of times they might be here all day. They might not be able to run to the cafe to grab food or get stuff out of the vending machine. So we'd like to make sure we have those available for them as well. And then vegetables, we like to make sure they're getting vegetables and fruits. And then the personal care items, we don't always get a lot of. So the shampoo, the conditioner, the body wash or soap, toothpaste, those type of items. We don't get deodorant, a lot of that as well.
Okay. You also mentioned that monetary donations are accepted and gratefully appreciated. How does one make a monetary donation? Is that something that we can do online through our HFC Foundation? I suspect it's so.
Yes. So if you go to the HFC website and if you just search Foundation Office, it'll pull up their website and they have a donate button on there. And you can just click on that. You just need to make sure that you also click on the Hawk's Nest is where you want your donation to go to make sure it goes to the right location.
Okay, great. So hfcc.edu, you can find the foundation site. Click donate and then designate it to go to the Hawk's Nest, and you can make a secure online donation that way. How urgent is the need, and what can we say to our listeners who are fortunate enough to not have things like food insecurity to have to worry about? How can we motivate people to get you what you need so that our students can be successful?
So right now we are fortunate that we do have a pretty good account for people who have donated to us in the past. And with not having as many students the past couple of years, we haven't had to spend as much. So we are fortunate right now, but as the need continues to grow this semester, it's going to be harder and harder for us to keep our shelves stocked for those students and be able to get them the food that they need. And our community, both on campus and off campus, have just been amazing. The last 6 years, 7 years that the pantry has been open and helping us to do that, because we run entirely on donations. So we've been fortunate that everyone has supported us these last years and helped us to make sure that these students are taken care of. But it will continue to get harder and harder as we move into the semester and more students start finding out about it and needing to use it.
Yeah. Manny, let's shift gears just a little bit to this other thing that exists on our campus, and something that is critically important for new students, but also pretty fun and kind of cool for returning students as well. So this is our sort of student-centered discussion today on this, the WHFR Journal, here on this Friday. Mandy Earle, involved in all aspects of student activities, and one of those is this thing we call Welcome Back Days. It is taking place the 19th through the 21st, and literally we are welcoming back Welcome Back Days to our campus. There will be some virtual stuff going on, as there has been the past couple of years, but also some physical on-the-ground things here at the campus of Henry Ford College. What have we got to look forward to this time around on September 19th to the 21st?
Well, we are so excited to be back on campus and doing Welcome Back Days in person. The last 2 years, we have done pretty much everything online for the students, still offering them activities. And we will continue to do some things online as well, because we found that some students would prefer to do that or just works better with their schedule. But this year, Welcome Back Days is back on campus, live events in person. This is a great opportunity for students to find out what they can get involved with on campus, meet other students, find out about the different departments. So there's a lot of students here that haven't physically been on campus and don't know all the amazing departments on campus and all the great services that are available to them. So one of the days will be devoted to that. So on Monday, we're going to start off on September 19th celebrating Constitution Day, which we do every year. This is going to be from 11 to 1 p.m. in the Student Center, which is Building M on the main campus. And we are going to have a table set up with just different games and fun things for students to learn and test their knowledge about Constitution Day. But we're also going to do a Kahoot trivia game that will take place in the Student Center. It's welcome to anyone to come by. And we will have prizes to give away for the winners of that trivia contest. And we'll be doing voter registration as well on Monday. And then Tuesday is another big day. We have National Voter Registration Day that we're celebrating. And we're going to be collaborating with the University of Michigan Dearborn on this event. It's going to take place outside. It's going to be a real giant party atmosphere, lots of fun things going on. It's going to be in the parking lot 11 outside of the athletic building, which is building H. And that goes from 3 o'clock until 7 o'clock. We will have inflatables, music, the Kona ice truck is coming, yard games, giveaways, voter registration, snacks, all kinds of great things going on for that event. So hopefully we'll see students out for that. And then we'll wrap it up on Wednesday, September 21st from 11 to 1 back in the Student Center. We're going to have our student club fair. So we'll have a lot of our student clubs there that students can come by, talk to the leadership for those clubs, find out more about it, and see if it's something they might want to get involved with. And as well, we'll have our student services there as well. So the different departments on campus, counseling, career services, the learning lab, different departments, math departments, stuff like that. They will have representatives there to answer questions and let students know what is available to them on campus. We're going to have a roving magician, a photo booth, an ice cream cart, snacks, giveaways, voter registration. And then we also have HSC Chorus and Blue Fusion that are going to come and perform. So you don't want to miss that because that's going to be exciting. And then we'll wrap it up with our virtual activity, which is a caricature artist. And that's going to take place from 2 to 5 p.m. online. We've done that the past 2 years and the students have loved that. So we're excited to bring that back again.
Oh, excellent. It sounds like so much fun. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, whether in person or online, lots of opportunities to connect or reconnect with Henry Ford College. Again, especially for our first timers on campus, maybe longtime students, but first time on campus, weird as that sounds. And then others that haven't been with us for a bit, come on back and check us out. Or if this is your very first experience in a college environment, really, this is the way to get acclimated, the way to learn not only important stuff about service and about opportunities and options with Constitution Day and Voter Registration Day, of course, but also particularly on that Wednesday, learning about resources that are available to you, the student of HFC, here on our campus and available online as well. And my favorite part is always the giveaways and the free food. So plenty of that. It really is a celebration and not meant to be just academic informational, but really meant for students to have fun. So the caricature thing that you're doing on Wednesday, next Wednesday, 2 to 5, is just a wonderful, wonderful addition. And I'm glad that you're keeping that sort of new tradition going. The other thing related to this that I'll mention again, the campus of Henry Ford College right here on Evergreen Road in Dearborn, the main campus just off of Ford Road. Parking can be a little bit of a challenge, but we encourage you, even if you're doing all of your classes remotely, if you're doing everything online and have not been to the campus yet as of that time for the semester or ever for that matter, this is not just for students that are physically attending in person. So we do want to let you know, if you're listening, you're like, oh, I'm doing all my classes online, and yeah, I feel a little disconnected. What a perfect opportunity to come to this beautiful campus and experience some of the splendor that is HFC. Mandy, I'm sure you thought about that when you and Cassandra and the whole team were making these plans. Yes.
Yes. We have a number of our student clubs who will still remain online as well. We're hoping that they will be here the day of, though, so that they can kind of meet the students and talk with them and let them know that there are still some online activities and stuff with the clubs as well.
Do we need to register in advance for all or any of this?
Nope. So none of it needs to be registered. Even the character artist event, you just show up during that time. So whatever fits in your schedule between 2 and 5, and you will get put into like a queue or a waiting list of who's next for the artist to draw. And while he's drawing others, you can actually watch them draw and you can interact with the artist as well. So it's interactive. He's great. We've used the same artist each time, and he's great with interacting with the students and making it really fun for them.
And who doesn't enjoy a good caricature of themselves, right?
And you can also have your family or whoever's at your house during that time, if they're there, get drawn with you. He's done like large groups, probably like 4 or 5, 6 different people that were there at the time together. So
that's very cool. Are you and your pet, your cat? Or
yeah, you've had some cats drawn in.
That's great. Oh, I love it. Well, school doesn't have to be only hard, stressful, and challenging. It can also be fun, and usually you learn stuff in the process anyway. So that's the beauty of welcome days, welcome back days, as we call it. It is a way to connect our student population with activities and opportunities and other people, like-minded people that have similar interests and so on. You have put a lot of time and effort into this, we can tell, and really all it needs is the students. So we encourage our students to check it out. You can find this information, by the way, right on the main website of HFC. It's hfcc.edu, and HFCC, I always say that stands for Henry Ford College Cares.edu, because it's true and we do. And you can learn more about the Welcome Back Days. WHFR will have a booth there, of course, and stop in and say hi, and we can tell you a little bit about our radio station and ways to get involved in that as well. And just, you know, more than we can possibly mention by way of service clubs and student clubs, as well as opportunities for direct connection with student services on campus as well. Some stuff you may not need it now, but maybe down the road it's something you want to think about. So this is a great way to do it. Mandy, I'd like to circle back just for a quick minute before we let you go and thank you for your time today. I know you're fighting a little something with your throat, but you're doing great. We alluded to donating online for the Hawk's Nest food drive, Stack the Pantry food drive, but I want to make sure that we clarify, circling back to that, if someone has a physical donation of items that they want to drop off, how does that work? Where should they bring the stuff? And do we need to call ahead for that too?
No. So there are a few boxes located on campus. There is one that sits out in front of the Hawk's Nest, so L138. There's one that sits in the lobby of campus safety, which is building N on campus. Our office collects donations, so that's M105, the Student Activities Office. And then for those who are working over in the Welcome Center, we have a box on the main floor, the first floor of that building as well, that we collect donations in.
Great. And to clarify, you don't have to be an employee of HFC to make a donation. We are looking, as you mentioned earlier, for our not only our campus community to support this, but our community at large.
Yeah.
Mandy, we're very fortunate to have you doing what you do and the entire Office of Student Activities, Cassandra Fluker included. We know we're in good hands with you being creative and thoughtful in your approach to supporting students and their success any step of the way, meeting them where they are to help keep this journey of academic learning moving forward. So thank you for your time, and we look forward to successful events. We'll report back and let everybody know how overwhelmingly successful these things are, but we can only do that with the support of our community, as we mentioned. Mandy, thank you for your time. Keep up the good work, and we wish you great success with both the food drive as well as the Welcome Back Days coming up right here in the month of September.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Right. Our pleasure. For more information, start at the HFC website. It's hfcc.edu. It's as simple as that. Mandy Earle joining us from the Office of Student Activities. We've got more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm the only station making waves. We are WHFR Dearborn. Please stick with us.
Yo, guys and dolls, join me, Daddy G, at the malt shop every Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time right here on WHFR.FM. The jukebox will be playing and we'll be spinning the platters from the 50s and 60s. So remember, that's the Malt Shop every Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. Be there or be square.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. So glad to have Susan McGraw and Mandy Earle talking about activities going on the Henry Ford College campus. And, of course, we welcome you all back to the HFC campus. And for our new students, we welcome you here for the first time. Let's see. We still have about a half hour to go in the program today. We've been listening slowly over the past few weeks to this series of podcasts from Viral Networks talking about media issues and things like that. And we're going to round out the four parts of this ultimately six-part series, so you're going to hear more of it in the future, that they have they've released so far. And this one is called Welcome to the Disinformation Industry. Are you contributing to a disinformation campaign without even knowing it? This week on Viral Networks, we will hear from Kate Starbird talking about unwillingly contributing to the spread of mis and disinformation. Remember, we heard about that a couple of weeks ago. Jonathan Corpus details the Filipino disinformation industry built on gig workers. And we'll hear from Yongmi Kim about Russia's intervention in Western politics. Another very interesting listen from Viral Networks. Welcome to the disinformation industry here on the WHFR Journal.
There's a lot of people who are complicit in disinformation production. It's not just a product of Duterte and his government. It's not just a product of three influencers who are queens of fake news. There's whole industries who are, you know, profiting off of this.
You're listening to Viral Networks, a look at the current state of mis and disinformation online with the scholars studying it from the front lines. We're your hosts, Emily Boardman and Deloy. You just heard from Jonathan Corpus Ong, who will be joining us today to tell us all about the alliance forged by advertising firms and contract laborers to produce viral disinformation in the Philippines.
Today, we're asking who produces disinformation and why do they do it? We'll be talking about the A in Camille Francois' disinformation, ABC, manipulative actors. And we won't just look at how these actors manipulate information, but how they manipulate other people to share and even create this content themselves.
That's exactly right. Kate Starbird will tell us all about how literally anybody could be swept up in a disinformation campaign. And after that, we'll hear from Jonathan Corpus Ong on how we might understand the Filipino disinformation industry as not just a political issue, but a labor issue. And finally, we'll talk to Yongmi Kim about how political actors use online advertising to deliver coordinated disinformation campaigns.
First up, Kate Starbird.
Yeah, I'm Kate Starbird. I'm an associate professor at the University of Washington in the Department of Human-Centered Design and Engineering, and I'm a co-founder of the UW Center for an Informed Public.
Kate studies how disinformation often flows in the aftermath of crisis events, such as natural disasters or mass shootings. Understanding the tactics employed by manipulative actors is a key part of this work. What do we know about the production of disinformation?
That's such a broad question, because there are so many, you know, just like all information has been democratized, right? So is disinformation. The tools of disinformation are now available to anybody who wants to use them. It doesn't take much to pick up some social media accounts, maybe make some friends or maybe create some bots and to start trying to spread information that could be used to deceive people for some for some purpose. And so I think there are many different kinds of production of disinformation. I've been really focused recently on participatory disinformation, where people who don't understand that they're part of a disinformation campaign begin to both amplify existing disinformation and even produce disinformation themselves that aligns with some political goal or other ideology of theirs. And so we've been, you know, really thinking about that element, but there's also very sort of coordinated disinformation where, you know, one organization will create some mechanism via maybe automated accounts or by hiring people and paying them to, you know, mass produce information that's meant to deceive for either a political objective or a financial objective or something else.
When we ask Kate to clarify if there are specific types of people who are more likely to unwittingly participate in spreading disinformation, she made it clear that it is not limited to less savvy internet users or people with certain political beliefs.
And I would say that all of us are vulnerable to becoming part of a disinformation campaign. Certainly in the 2016 data that we had, we were looking at Black Lives Matter discourse in the United States. We were looking at pro-Black Lives Matter and anti-Black Lives Matter content, and Russian disinformation campaign, a Russian disinformation campaign for the Internet Research Agency, infiltrated both sides, and they were highly retweeted by political elites on the right, and they were highly retweeted by folks on the left. I do believe that I know that I either followed or retweeted one of their accounts in that context, and Jack at Twitter, the CEO, retweeted one of the IRA accounts. So we're all vulnerable to disinformation. I think there are asymmetries in how much disinformation has infiltrated, especially the political right in the United States, but that's happening in other places as well. And certainly, I think some people are more vulnerable than others and more likely to encounter it. But I think it's important to understand we're all vulnerable, but also that right now there's an asymmetric use of disinformation to support the rise of authoritarian right-wing populist movements around the world.
The way Kate described participatory disinformation to us made a lot of sense. Everyone online is vulnerable to it because the people pushing disinformation are trying to cast a wide net.
But we felt like this all begged the question, did these campaigns work because they were highly coordinated or because the people leading them just did such a good job at creating content that could spread naturally?
I think there's different kinds of disinformation, or perhaps even different states of a disinformation campaign. There definitely is that coordinated stuff. We saw that with the Internet Research Agency in Russia. We've seen that with other in other countries and other contexts. In the U.S., we've seen right-wing organizations pay trolls to spread content as well. So this is something that happens. So we've got that orchestrated or coordinated content. But then there's also the stuff that's just cultivated, where, you know, some political actors may, you know, be inserting some things or amplifying things that they like or helping those things rise to the top, but they're not necessarily, you know, they're not creating all the content. In many cases, you know, people who are unwitting agents are creating the content themselves. And then we get to these purely organic things where the disinformation agents are either gone or they're just kind of watching, and you know this content can sort of be organically created by folks who have begun to believe that these ways of in these meta narratives and these ways of seeing the world are the ways that they now see the world, and they can generate that content.
Kate made sure to point out, though, that not all people producing and promoting disinformation are motivated by politics. Many are motivated by profit too.
So many of the folks spreading this and disinformation are motivated by financial goals. We've seen that across so many different contexts, but I remember my first study of disinformation. I had just realized that that's what we were studying. We'd been looking at these conspiracy theories during crisis events and just began to realize that they had this element of disinformation. And so many of the websites that were spreading these claims that these crisis events or these shooting events weren't happening. They said they were all being staged by crisis actors. I'm sure you've heard these claims, but we had been seeing this for several years. And so I went to kind of look at all the websites that were pushing out those false claims. And so many of them had advertisements for nutritional supplements. I can't tell you how many of them. It had a whole, like, I was doing hand coding, qualitative coding, and I had a whole category for, like, is it selling us nutritional supplements? Yes. There's a whole, you know, Natural News, these kinds of like alternative health sites that become, you know, mass propagators of conspiracy theories and false information, in part to drive people to their websites so they can sell them things. And often that, you know, when it intersects with some of these pseudoscience narratives, which the COVID misinformation often does, that leads to these alternative health products. And that becomes a whole industry that drives, you know, that drives these websites. And so certainly many of the folks that are in this space, they can get low quality content that's often, no one's going to care if they share it because it's got, someone created it for a political motive or something else. And so they push out this low quality content. It's easy for them to generate or copy and paste. And then they pull people into their website to see their advertisements and to sell them products. And so certainly financial motives are pushing a lot of that disinformation ecosystem. And then others, like the reputational stuff, we see folks that they want to be influencers, and to become an influencer, you know what? Spreading sensational conspiracy theories is one way to get a lot of attention. Being first on the scene, on the virtual scene of a crisis event, and then, you know, creating the political frames for that event that your side finds valuable, that gives people a lot of attention. And we can see that being a strategy of many influencers many social media all-stars or these kind of new social media influencers. That's a strategy they use to grow their audiences. And at first, it does seem like just the reputation alone is motivation enough. Oh, look, I'm getting more followers. I'm getting more attention. And eventually, those folks leverage that for political motives or financial motives or both.
At this point in the interview, Kate had given us a pretty good idea of who produces disinformation and why. But we were still curious about her concept of participatory disinformation. We wanted to know exactly how it works, and Kate offered a salient example from the 2020 election.
One of the examples we have is something we called Sharpiegate, where people went to vote and they were given Sharpie pens to fill out their votes in person on election day. And the Sharpie pens bled through the ballots. The ballots were actually designed that way, and it was not going to affect whether or not they were counted, but it made people concerned. And after they handed in their ballot, they went home and they convinced themselves online that their ballots hadn't been counted. And then they went to this tool that gave them the status of their ballot, and it said canceled. Except the tool said the status of their mail-in ballot, which was canceled when they voted in person. But they convinced themselves, they didn't see that. Well, you can see it if you look. It was right there in front of them. They didn't notice. But they misinterpreted the evidence they misinterpreted their own experiences through this frame. They were expecting voter fraud, and then they became convinced that they had been disenfranchised and that they had been part of this voter fraud to disenfranchise specifically Trump voters, because that's what they were expecting. That's who they were, and that's how they saw the world. And so we can see that becomes, and it becomes promoted. It becomes part of the Stop the Steal narrative, is drawn from Sharpiegate. It's one of many narratives that fed into it, and it ends up motivating the violence on January 6th. And so we can see that kind of that participatory and almost organic nature of disinformation happening in that case. And it's not purely organic, because the elites amplified. They found that evidence, they amplified, and they organized around it. So it's this intersection between these participatory audiences, these unwitting crowds, and these political elites that understand the keys to their power is in working with these crowds to help perpetuate their narratives. If it's so easy to convince ourselves that we can't trust the results of a democratic election, I don't know what the future holds for democracy.
I've been thinking on the call about how you have such a unique long view of this problem, working deeply in this for over 10 years now. It does sound like, even just in the example you gave between the two elections, that this, we're in a much worse place now with disinformation than in 2016. I'm just trying to understand how the problem has amplified over time and what you would say about that.
I do think that we're in a little bit better position right now just because of like sort of a collective awareness. But I'm not convinced that's going to be enough, because I think the challenge is really steep.
the ways that we inform ourselves about the world have been and are being profoundly changed. And that is going to reconfigure how people think about each other, how we think about our governments, how we think about the collective challenges we face as a globe. All of these things are experiencing rapid change.
I really like Kate's last point, that there are a lot of collective challenges we face around the globe, and disinformation is just one of them. As we'll hear from our next guest, those questions about how we understand ourselves and each other, how we think about our governments, those are relevant to disinformation outside of the U.S. context, too.
Jonathan Corpus Ong joins us next to tell us about his work studying disinformation in his home country, the Philippines. As digital work proliferates there, so does the cottage industry of advertising firms and contract workers manipulating conversations on social media.
I'm Jonathan Corpus Ong. I'm Associate Professor of Communication at UMass Amherst, and I'm also a Research Fellow at Harvard Kennedy School and the Shorenstein Center's TASK Project. The Philippines is a social media capital of the world. The Philippines has been ranked in global surveys as having the most active users on social media. I believe up to 5 hours per day is the average time, average Filipino citizen, and that's the average time that they spend on Facebook and other social media. So the intensity of activity in social media is very much there. And therefore, our digital industries, our creative industries, are very well versed in campaigning, the different kinds of digital operations, from search engine optimization to website development to data analytics, and they're able to offer their services to regional clients.
Jonathan told us that his work on these topics began around 2015 or 16, studying the condition of digital labor in his home country, the Philippines. He was motivated largely by the working conditions of the laborers that American social media companies hired to moderate content on their platforms. Often, these Filipino laborers were left to deal with the most disturbing content, getting paid significantly less than what these American companies would have to pay American workers.
And the story at the time was really more on the Philippines as a social media content moderation capital of the world. So along with India, right? So the Philippines is known for having these content moderators in these outsourced work arrangements, being the digital janitors, scrubbing the filth off of Facebook. And so they're exposed to violence, gore, dick pics, etc., and having to endure like really difficult work conditions. And at the same time, of course, like as the story was developing, we had all the discussion about what social media might be doing to politics in the form of like troll farms, paid troll workers for elections, Trump, Duterte, etc. And so I thought it was just a really interesting way of like interconnecting like two different research interests of mine, politics and also digital workers. So you have this story of, on one hand, these kinds of call center work arrangements of the content moderator scrubbing filth off of Facebook, while on the other hand, they could be sitting right next to trolls, paid trolls, actually producing all of that filth, right, for politicians in the Philippines or, and maybe even for overseas clients. So I found that important to talk about from a very human-centered perspective.
As an ethnographer, Jonathan dove into this production of viral content in the Philippines. What he discovered surprised him, something that very closely resembles what Kate Starbird calls participatory disinformation.
my work on the disinformation architects, architects of network disinformation, our 2018 report was really based on interviews with campaign strategists, influencers, fake account operators, and also digital ethnography, seeing how what they told us in the interview actually played out in our own analysis of how certain campaigns ran, how certain hashtags were actually instantiated in social media. There was one hashtag called hashtag nasaan ang pangulo, which translates to hashtag where is the president, which a campaigner in an interview told us that that was her idea. So she took credit for it in the context of an interview. Oh, remember that campaign? I was the mastermind behind it. It's like, oh my God, we had no idea. We thought it was purely organic. It was a hashtag campaign that tried to see doubt in the former president, and trying to see that in his ability to lead a crisis because he was nowhere to be seen. And it kind of like set the stage for a strongman president to come in, like Duterte, right? Like he's not like the absentee president. And so we look at the origins, who were the most active posters and which were the most active influencers advancing that hashtag. And we confirmed it, that it was a set of parody accounts. So like meme pages that were really intentionally, that was driving that conversation, but was taken forward by ordinary people, also by mainstream media that covered that hashtag.
Are these jobs in the sense of ongoing engagements for pay? Is this someone's way to provide for their families that they're being paid to do this?
This info for hire, right? I think in the Philippines, one needs to understand paid troll work within the broader context of our economy, and how, first of all, creative industries and digital work, these have been also embraced by the state as sunshine industries. Right. And so there's like official government discourse to embrace digital work and even like those business process outsourced firms. And they're celebrated as good for the economy. And for you to participate in that, you're being in a way kind of like a hero. If you're part of the digital workforce, it's something that can progress the country toward new heights. We say in our work that nobody was really hired to become a full-time troll. Like this is a project-based arrangement, sometimes 3 months, sometimes a six-month short-term project. And you kind of juggle your consultancy for a politician or to advance like a particular narrative, right? A political narrative, alongside other kinds of gigs that you have. And so this is seen as something that, yeah, can help sustain their family. But that's not the only kind of arrangement.
And is political advancing political candidates or pulling down others the main way that these sorts of jobs are engaged, or is it also, for example, is health coming in there, commercial interests? What is sort of the subject scope of this type of work?
What interested me the most and what I saw as like driving most of the disinformation narratives is that it's from an advertising and public relations kind of model, where it's a politician enlisting like a brand executive to assemble like teams that can improve their image, but also like smear their rival candidate. So it's what I call the advertising and PR disinformation work model. And that's what's most predominant in terms of how the most dominant disinformation narratives and most insidious influence operations are strategized and coordinated. And so you ask whether is it mostly political. Actually, what we found in our work is that it was mostly corporate, right? Like that's, or at least that's how it started. So before they even meet a politician, the advertising and PR executives would be very boastful about and would be citing all of their experience in the corporate marketing world. So like the question, like in my interviews, when I ask ad and PR executives, I ask them, so how do you pitch your services to a political client? Like, what does that first meeting sound like? And they'll often say, oh, I cite my portfolio, how I had done this for soft drink brands, for shampoo brands. I was able to have this hashtag trend worldwide for a shampoo brand, and they claim credit for that. And of course, it lends an aura of professional respectability, right? For you to be associated with like a Coca-Cola, right? Or a Johnson & Johnson. And therefore, like a politician will be enticed, oh, this person seems to know what they're doing. And also it doesn't feel like they're going into a very shady transaction, if you know what I mean.
Jonathan told us that while Filipinos are aware of these disinformation efforts, thanks to robust independent journalism, news coverage doesn't often reveal the full scale of this disinformation ecosystem. Most coverage focused on a few especially notable bad actors who spread disinformation, including one figure the Filipino press dubbed the Queen of Fake News. Jonathan thinks these notable figures are just one part of a bigger problem.
There's a lot of people who are complicit in disinformation production. It's not just a product of Duterte and his government. It's not just a product of three influencers who are queens of fake news. There's whole industries who are, you know, profiting off of this. It's not as simple as, you know, deplatforming, erasing, canceling one person, one personality, and everything will be better. But it's really to understand, oh, there's so many layers here of exploitation, self-exploitation, also aspiration. They're just doing it to get by, provide for their family. But what is clear in my work is that I assign responsibility to the politician and to the mastermind of the campaign, and how those people at the very top, we need to have a much stronger discourse of accountability to hold those people into account.
So Kate Starbird helped us understand how this information is often produced and spread by people who don't even realize that's what they're doing. And Jonathan told us about how an actual industry has cropped up in the Philippines to manufacture such content. For the most part, what they're talking about is viral content. Memes, videos, articles, hashtags. But that's only part of the story.
So far, we've avoided talking about paid advertising, which is a really significant vector for disinformation online. We invited Young Mi Kim from the University of Wisconsin-Madison to tell us a bit about her research studying political ads online and how she learned that many of them are the result of coordinated disinformation campaigns.
Hi, I'm Young Mi Kim, professor of the School of Journalism, Mass Communication, and faculty affiliate the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
To study paid ads leading up to the 2016 U.S. general election, Young Mi and her research team set out to reverse engineer who were the sponsors paying for the ads and what kinds of individuals were being targeted by these ads.
The research team developed an app to track political ads that users saw around the web, including on social media. About 10,000 people volunteered to take part in the study, which let Young Mi and her team sample 50,000 ads focused on specific policy issues such as abortion, LGBTQ rights, gun ownership, immigration, race, and so on.
The big discovery of this project is that we found many unidentifiable, untrackable, unattributable groups, namely like suspicious groups. And we found that more than half of the sponsors of the Facebook ads turned out to be a suspicious group. And then later, one out of six of these suspicious groups turned out to be Russian groups. Those are run by, in fact, the Internet Research Agency, information operative, like one by linked to Putin.
Yarmi's team came to believe that these ads were being funded by what many in our field call AstroTurf campaigns. These are efforts which are funded by corporate or political players masquerading as grassroots organizations.
Participants like, believe that these are true grassroots, but like some of the members of like groups could be just like planted by organizers. It gives like a false sense of community, but also like a false sense of like a public opinion.
For her research purposes, it was always suspicious if an organization purchasing an ad on social media wasn't registered with the Federal Election Commission or the Internal Revenue Service. If that group was domestic, then they were certainly breaking the law. But there is also a good possibility that those groups were actually foreign actors who would not be subject to United States elections and tax laws. In her eyes, either of these are good indications of AstroTurf efforts.
Those government agencies regulate political advertising during elections, so ads on social media are a logical focus for Yarmi's research.
We believe that advertising analysis is a great starting point to detect like, a coordination because advertising is an outcome of the deliberate strategies, particularly like, targeting and messaging strategies. So by analyzing advertising, like targets and then messaging and their connections, we can come to like a one-step closure to understanding like, underlying strategies. You know, for example, we tracked back all those suspicious actors' ad code. So any website domains, like a domain registration information and things like that. Like, so we can see whether there is an overlap in ownership.
Once Yarmi and her team have identified that suspicious code, they can begin to understand how these actors are leading their campaigns. Here, she's looking at something we'll talk more about in episode 5, coordination.
And we also analyze the, you know, synchronous of messaging, whether they share the same message and then link to each other. So it's not just like, you know, sharing the messages, but group A refers to like a group B, things like that. Then we consider that like, there is a group like, a track link, or whether they have the exact same like a contact information. So based on this direct evidence, like we identified more than like 30% of these suspicious groups are directly connected to each other. We analyzed like nearly 500 like, groups, like suspicious groups and then directly linked nonprofits or unregistered groups and see whether there are some like a, you know, direct relationship so that we can remove the, you know, indirect relationship or weak relationship and then only identify the groups that have like a direct relationship. What we found is, our conclusion is that the suspicious groups are not like a random groups. They are highly coordinated and probably coordinated by like, one campaign. And then this campaign is also related to Russian groups because some of these like, groups are directly linked to like, Russia.
At the time we're recording this episode, Yarmi is at work applying similar methods described here to research the 2020 U.S. presidential election. But an initial analysis of 32 IRA-like Instagram accounts dating to September 2019 suggested similar behavior as what she found in her 2016 study.
You can reference the show notes for this episode to find Yarmi's report in Stealth Media, as well as research by Kate and Jonathan.
Well, that wraps up this episode of Viral Networks. In our next episode, we'll be talking more about the how of disinformation campaigns, coordination, inauthentic behavior, and other techniques actors use to spread bad information online. Viral Networks is a production of Media Ecosystems Analysis Group. We're your hosts, Emily Boardman and Dulloy.
And Fernando Bermejo.
All episodes are produced and edited by Mike Sugarman. Julia Hong joined us as a scriptwriter and provided additional research. Music on this show was composed by Neil and our producer, Mike. Funding to produce this series was provided by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And last but certainly not least, we want to give a big thank you to all of the experts who joined us for interviews on this show.
Wrapping up today's WHFR Journal with Welcome to the Disinformation Industry from Viral Networks, a podcast we've been working our way through here on the program over the past few weeks. My name's Alan Mazurek. Thanks for being with us. We've got blues for your Friday afternoon. We'll take a trip down Highway 61 coming up in just a moment. From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, WHFR.fm, broadcasting globally online, making waves. Have a great weekend. Enjoy your Friday afternoon. We'll be back next week with more on the WHFR Journal.
These are the sounds of a dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.
Hi, this is Willie Porter, thanking you for supporting WHFR Dearborn.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.